Live from Washington, D.C., this is Warbird Radio.
Hey, y'all, Tuck Carlson here, introducing my new video series, Tuck Carlson's How to Be a Warbird Pilot. I don't care what you fly. Warbird pilots are the coolest, and I can teach you how to be one. Best part is, you don't even need a plane. Hell, you don't even need to know what a Warbird is just by my video. Inside, you'll learn all the important stuff, like how to fit a flight suit around a beer belly, and why that beer belly is a safety feature. How to ignore small children at air shows. Ain't got time for that. How to grow your ego and sign unreadable autographs. Plus, you'll learn why freedom's the greatest answer to any question. Hey, Tuck, why do you fly these awesome airplanes? For freedom? Or when your wife finds out how much you've spent? Damn it, Tuck. Why'd you spend $6,000 on Avgas? For freedom. So for freedom's sake, buy my video. Before long, people be thinking you're somebody. You'll be sitting around campfires with real women, signing autographs, and petting pretty little baby bald eagles that you grew in redwood trees that you planted beside your hangar. Be awesome, love freedom, and get your copy of Tuck Carlson's How to Be a Warbird Pilot right now. Hey, y'all, hurry, and I'll toss in a special bonus pack. Tuck Carlson's How to Look Good in Short Shorts Late at Night and in the Pilot Briefing. Trust me, short shorts are the coolest things ever. Call now!
Supporting these the old-fashioned way. This is Warbird Radio. Tune in. Take off.
Good evening, good evening. This is Zane Adams with the Texas Warbird Report. It's our first show of 2017. I think it's show number 18 since we've been doing this for a couple of years, and skip a month here and there. Things get, we get busy, get air shows, go, you know, got things to do. So other than talk on the radio, but here we are. We're live here on warbirdradio.com. Remember, the studio line is going to be open tonight at 478-787-4768. Or you can call us on Skype at Warbird Radio. So we'll be here for the next hour or so. I've got a couple of great guests, and we're going to talk some airplanes, talk some history. And that's what we do here on Warbird Radio. And this is a little bit of Texas twist on it, since it is the Texas Warbird Report. We're a big state with a lot of flying airplanes in it, so we try to, and a lot of airplane history. So we try to cover them all best we can. And, you know, that's what we do. Had a good time at the end of the year last year. I know in late October, went out to the Mid-America Flight Museum with Scott Glover's gang over there in Mount Pleasant, Texas. And he had the 46th annual World War II Glider Pilots Association over there. Went over there, spent the day, had a great time. It's a great little museum in Mount Pleasant. If you're out there during the weekends, out 1 hour or so east of Dallas, it's worthwhile to stop in there. He's got a great collection of airplanes, and Scott and his gang are really a wonderful bunch of people. And they hosted the glider pilots reunion. They had some 20 odd veterans pilots out there. They took them all flying in C-47 and put all the pilots, the World War II vets that wanted to and that could, they stuffed them in the back of a Mustang and went flying. They had a really, really great weekend. I've got a few stories here that Matt and I'll work on and get plugged in and edit down and be some good stories from these guys. Really interesting, and it was a really fun time. And then in November, the CAF headquarters squadron, based here in Dallas, Texas now, has had their first air show, the Wings Over Dallas show, and it was a big hit. Crowds, I think, overwhelmed them. It's a lot more crowd than they thought. It was an interesting show with some vet interviews out on the ramp, and it's it was a good show, and I had a good time, and I got to go flying with Mark Todd, and it was a good time. So we'll have stories about that later as well. So we'll go straight to our guest here. There's a flying airplane, a seaplane out of Conroe, Texas. They call Zeus. And I've got on the line here Stuart Lawrence. Stuart, you there?
I am here, Zane. Good chatting with you this evening.
Yeah, I appreciate you being on. And you've got Mike Bielka as one of your partners in crime there with you?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. Great. I'm glad you guys are with us. And before we get started here, we've got a caller on the line. You want to take a call and see what happens?
Oh, that's scary, but sure, we'll start off with the call.
All right, bring them up. Let's see who we got here. Well, maybe not.
Well, they're there. Go ahead, caller. Are you there?
Hey, I'm Mike Parksdale from Conroe.
How are you?
I'm good, and you?
Doing well. So do you know these two guys?
I normally don't say it out loud, but yes, I do.
Be careful how you answer that, Mike.
great guys, great airplane. I've enjoyed being around the project.
Well, cool. I'm glad you're here.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Thanks. All right. Well, there you go. So that wasn't too bad. So
there's our fan club of one. Okay, good.
Yeah, there you go. All right, Stuart, tell us a little bit about to start with the airplane. I know the Albatross was a active duty airplane all over the world and went from like 1949 till the Greeks quit flying it in 95. Tell us a little bit about your airplane.
Yes, we're actually sitting here at world headquarters of Albatross Adventures, where this whole thing started. Mike and I came up with this idea one night over scotch and cigars. Probably copious quantities of both, it got rolling. So kind of an interesting thing at the time. My family was traveling the country in an RV. I was working nonstop back then in the oil business, so they just cruised the country, homeschooling the boys anyway, and getting a great education. So we got in this conversation about how great it would be to be able to expand the borders somewhat beyond RV, and we started talking maybe boats. And Mike mentioned this idea of, man, I've got the perfect thing. It's a flying RV. It's a flying boat. I said, you're talking about the Albatross. I know that plane. It goes back to my days being raised on a sailboat in the Bahamas, and I was sitting there swinging on the hook in Bimini, and chalks flew in with an Albatross. It is
sure
just the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my life. I thought, yeah, one of these days, yeah, sure, I'm going to own one of those. So Mike and I got talking and said, it'd be perfect. Let's see if we can get one. Of course, we Googled them and see if any were for sale and said, holy smokes, you can pick one up for the price of a sports car and split it in half. Let's do it. We'll just buy one of these and go fly around the world, take the family around the world. That was the dream.
Yeah. That was a Lamborghini sports car, by the way.
Yeah,
I wouldn't achieve sports car. That was at least a Lambo.
Oh, yeah. Well, as all airplanes know, buying the airplane's the cheap part, right?
Well, yeah. Most people know that. We didn't at the time, fortunately, or we had never actually gone through with it. But, we did. We went out and got our first one, and fortunately found a lot of support with our partner in this thing now. Pat Deegan is just an amazing guy. He'll sit and read the manual on every piece of equipment on the plane and know everything about it. So he's the one that keeps us on the straight and narrow. And then we've got crew member Skeet Emmon, who is amazing at making sure all our pre-flight's done properly and helping out there. And then you've got guys like Mike Barksdale just called in, who's out there right now trying to get his multi-C so he can help fly to events. So we put together actually a pretty big crew of folks who all volunteer their time and do it all just for the love of the airplane like we did.
Yeah, well, you got to have those people in there. I know you got to have somebody that's got their name on the flight, the airworthiness certificate. But you've got to have volunteers, and especially with a large airplane like this airplane or any other warbird. That expertise spread around the work and everything else really comes in handy.
Absolutely, and So we got going with that, and we had the crew together, and we thought, well, what the heck? You know, we've got one. Let's go ahead and buy another one.
Mistake number two.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, not so much a mistake. Actually, a friend of ours had worked on the one we currently have, Zeus, and actually brought it out of the desert. They worked on it for years, get it flying again, and he had he got to a point where he couldn't own the airplane any longer and made us a great deal on it. So we bought Zeus, and all of a sudden we had two airplanes. The first one we had actually named Pegasus, you know, the flying horse. We thought that was appropriate.
There you go.
And we have since, fortunately, found a really good guy who bought that from us, and he still flies with us. It's actually parked at Conroe right now, but he's out of Maryland area normally. So we have two of them on the ramp in Conroe right now. But it was a good deal to get that one going and get him on board with it. And it's a flyer, and now we've got Zeus in really good shape, and it's a flyer. We actually, in November, we had those two plus Connie Edwards. Most people in the Warbird community probably know of Connie. He's got,
yeah, everybody knows Connie.
Yeah, but he's got his Coast Guard colored one, and sure, the three of us got together in November and did some playing around out on Lake Conroe and got some aerial photography, which you can find on the Facebook page, Everything Albatross. There are a lot of great pictures, and as well as videos that our fans have taken.
Now, that's I've seen some of those. Seen some of those shots. Glenn Watson and Chris Edmond put both of them. I guess we're along in the photo ship and around, and some beautiful photos. And it's really cool to see the three airplanes stacked up like that. And like I said, playing around in the water and everything else. That's a fantastic deal.
Yeah, and Glenn did an amazing, amazing job with it. And Chris as well, getting some good shots. But what a ball. We hit the weather just perfect. It's kind of iffy sometimes in November, but it was an absolutely, you know, stunning few days out there playing around with the albatrosses.
We've decided to make this kind of a semi-annual event, gathering of Grummins, and this was the first one was kind of short notice, and we got three airplanes down there, but we got a couple other albatross owners that are interested in joining us on the next one. We hope to get four or five of them going at the same time, something that doesn't happen very often, and get some more good aerial photos, and just have a good collection of people. They're all really great people that are involved in this. JB, who bought Pegasus, is a good friend of ours, and he's as interested in it as he's a retired Navy test pilot. And I was a Navy pilot also, where I first saw the albatross when I was a student down in Pensacola a while back.
Yeah, a while back, yeah.
yeah. And they're actually still flying. That's how a while back it was. But I got a job as a commercial pilot. I've been flying for the airlines for 35 years, and that kind of provided me with the wherewithal to partner up with Studi and get this thing rolling.
Yeah. Well, you know, our friend of Warbird Radio, Scott Glover, up there in Mount Pleasant's got an albatross that's seaworthy as well. So I know that there's at least four of them, I guess, flying in Texas, huh?
Yeah, we know Scott real well. He's a great guy. He's and it's a small community. You kind of get to know everybody through a process of there's just not that many of us around, and we all need parts. And one of the things that you were saying earlier, that parts are a big thing in keeping these things flying, and that's proved to be one of the more difficult hurdles to just get the parts to keep these things moving in the air, because things break. They're old airplanes. They're 60-year-old airplanes, and some of them have been sitting for quite a while. So you've got to have a good parts supply line, and you got to help each other out. It's just a community that everybody kind of gets together, and we'll call up any given day. Someone will call and go, I need a fuel pump, or I need this or that, and we all help each other out to keep them flying. That's kind of the fun of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as far as parts go, I mean, your engines, what are you? You 1830s or are you?
182076 Charlie is the model on most of them.
Okay.
And it's a pretty ubiquitous engine. There's a lot of parts for that. Where you get into difficulty is the prop is unique on that airplane because it's a full reversing prop.
Okay.
So it's they're kind of scarce because what happened years ago, the P-51 guys found out they could take them and cut them down and use them on P-51s when they started running out of P-51 props. So they kind of, the supply of those kind of dried up, and that's one of the really important things to have because they're nickel plated in order to resist the water,
sure.
the corrosion that occurs on the water. So they don't allow nickel plating anymore. The EPA doesn't allow that. So the supply that's out there is the supply that's out there. So that's one of the really critical parts of this airplane to have in stock.
Yeah. And I guess, so you're kind of like running on helicopter rotor blades then. You get time limits and supply limits. You know, that makes it tough.
Yeah, you learn to stockpile parts. You learn that when you find them, you buy them just because right. you don't know when the next one's going to come available. So we were fortunate enough to buy out a cache of parts out in California here a couple of years ago, and we keep those handy. A lot of stuff you'll never use in 100 years of flying this airplane. Landing gear parts, hopefully you don't have to use, but you never know when a part becomes necessary, and that's how the system works. You just start calling around and say, who's got what?
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, I know there was, I guess, two or three. Well, Connie Edwards' airplane was up there at Oshkosh this year. I know there was a couple parked out on the out in the grass there, so there's a few around, but like you said, there's not many, and but... otherwise, systems-wise and flying it-wise, I mean, operation of costs, is it, you know, I've heard it's about like flying a DC-3 as far as fuel burn and everything else?
Pretty much. We fly plan for $120 gallons an hour. You figure about, you know, generally around $1,000 an hour with maintenance costs and insurance and all that. So it's not a cheap proposition, so it helps to have a group of people supporting you. Now, there's two kinds of people that get involved with Albatross. Once upon a time when we first met Connie, he said, welcome to one of the most exclusive clubs in the world, people that own these airplanes. And we learned real quick there's either people that are crazy like Stuart and I, or there's people that are rich and crazy like Connie, and that... That do this stuff. They call them eccentric, I think, is rich and crazy.
We're just playing crazy.
Yeah.
There you go.
But you got to love the airplane. You got to love what it does. And like I said, I've been flying for close to 40 years now, or maybe a little bit more than that, and got a lot of flight time. But this is some of the most exciting and enjoyable flying I've ever done. It's just, there's nothing quite like landing on the water. The first time you do it, it's just the biggest rush. And it's a different challenge, and there's a lot to know about it. Stu Dawson, who you probably know, pointed out a while back, he said, you know, he said, once you get that thing on the water, it's an entirely different vehicle, and it can bite you real quick. And he's right. It's a challenge to put that thing on the water and take it off again. So we're learning as we go. And fortunately, there's some great guys out there. Ronnie Gardner, who you probably know, helped us out a lot. Charlie Hainlein, who sold us Zeus, is another Warbird enthusiast, flies a lot of Warbirds for different people. And
that's that tuna guy.
The tuna man, yeah, he's a good guy. He flies with me in the commercial airline industry, and that's kind of how we got to know each other. And so we have a lot of fun, and he comes out, and we'll on any given day just take it out for a couple hours on the water and learn new things.
Yeah. Well, so when you're flying, and I know there's certain rules and regulations in a lot of most folks out there are land pilots. I know you've got to be careful where you put the airplane. I guess boaters might freak out if they, see you landing out on the water and, and I guess certain municipalities, certain lakes allow them and don't allow them. And I know you can't land one in Colorado at all, but that's a different story. But, what do you go about as far as putting it on the water, your preparation for that, legally and room and everything else?
Well, first of all, George Bush, when he was governor of Texas, passed a great law on seaplanes that any public body of water that allows motorboats cannot restrict seaplanes from landing.
Yeah,
so
there you go.
Really opened up the waterways. Now, obviously, just like with a boat, you are responsible for operating safely. So, having permission and wanting to pick a particular body of water are different things. So, yes, you scout locations, you scout lakes, and certainly you do your flyover to make sure your path is clear. We're very spoiled here in Conroe. Lake Conroe is the perfect seaplane lake. It's not fed by any large rivers, and so when you have heavy rains like we've been having, you don't have big influxes of logs and flotsam to worry about.
Right.
So that's a perfect venue for us. Lake Livingston, on the other hand, just a little bit farther north and east, is a great lake, but it's fed by a river. It's a much shallower lake in many places. When you're landing and you see the birds standing on the water, you get a little nervous.
Yeah.
this plane does draw more than 4 feet.
Okay.
Which,
yeah.
I've operated many large sailboats with shallower drafts than that.
Yeah. So 4 feet is your I guess your absolute minimum. You want, I guess, 6 or whatever, right?
Pretty much. And one of the interesting things you talk about, first time we showed up on Lake Conroe, we attracted a lot of attention, and we got to know the sheriff and the local river authority real well that first week. In fact, they said our record for the first couple times we got on the lake is 41 911 calls for an airplane crashing on the lake.
Our favorite
story was when the sheriff came up one time. He said he had a call from a lady who said, big airplane just crashed on Lake Conroe. He goes, okay, man, what happened next? She goes, it took off and came around and crashed again.
Well, there you go.
So we do, we have a good relationship with the guys, and before we take off anymore, we give them a call and let them notify the emergency services that we'll be out there probably attracting calls.
Well, I know you guys post, I've seen it, try to post it on Facebook or social media, get the word out that you guys will be out there. I guess helps to minimize some of that.
Well, actually, it kind of works against you on minimizing the issues, because we have a big following on Facebook now, and people will launch their boats and get out there waiting for us, and suddenly... A perfectly clear lake becomes filled with boats who are very interested in us, but they've been very good of staying out of the way. It's an amazing group of folks out there who show up anytime we give them any kind of notice, and they'll line the shores. Some of the videos that you find on Everything Albatross Facebook page, those were all taken by fans and. Have shared those and posted on the YouTube. So it's always a great event. We always try to give as much advance notice as possible, but you know how it is with, with big warbirds. Trying to predict when you're going to be out there and if you're going to be out there can be difficult.
Sure. So how do you, there's not very many multi-engine seaplanes really running around. So I guess the instructors and the guys that sign you off, I guess they're a little slim and a little hard to get come by as well.
That's one of the more difficult things to do is to get rated in the airplane. Pat and I initially went out and got our single-engine seaplane rating and then got a multi-engine seaplane rating. But to get the Albatross rating is difficult just because you've got to have three things come together. You've got to have the airplane, you got to have an instructor, and then you got to have someone to sign you off. There's only a couple of people out there that will sign you off on them, and getting everything to come together takes quite a while. The airplane's got to be working. It takes probably around 16 hours of instruction in the airplane before you're ready to go for your check ride, and then you got to line up someone like Stu Dawson or Ronnie Gardner to get out there and get your check ride. So it's not an easy thing to do, and a lot of people want to fly them, and to get the rating in the airplane, you've got to have multi-engine seaplane rated pilot and co-pilot for anything you do on the water.
Yeah.
So those they're kind of scarce, and
sure.
A lot of people you know, don't necessarily want to spend the money to go out and get a multi-seat, because even that's kind of difficult. You have to go to Florida, or there's only a few places and a few airplanes that will allow you to do that.
Yeah, and I guess what you start in something smaller like a Widgeon or something like that? Or
well, we did a Twin B, Ricky Rose, a friend of mine, and he's got a little Twin B operation down in Florida, and we got our multi-engine seaplane rating in a Twin B, which is an airplane I'll probably never fly again, but it filled the square. And since then, they've changed the regulations now. You couldn't, in the past, you couldn't get your multi-seat and your type rating in the Albatross at the same time. And they've changed that regulation now to make it a little more streamlined, so you can get your multi-engine C and your type rating at the same time, which makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah.
JB, the guy that bought our blue and white airplane Pegasus, he was able to do that because he came a couple years after us. But it's a pretty arduous. You got to really want to do it. I mean, you got to put the time and effort into it. And it's a complex aircraft. It's, if you're going to learn in an airplane, it's there's a lot more to it than just a multi-engine rating.
Sure. Sure. Now, and well, it's a type rating, and it's a seaplane type rating. I mean, like you said, it all stacks up. You know, you got your multis, you got your round motors, you got
yeah.
got it all. Yeah, yeah. The systems
there's
alone.
There's nothing cheap about it. That's for sure. But
yeah.
I tell you what, you know, once you get out there and you put it on the water, it's absolutely impossible to get the smile off your face.
Yeah, that's what Glover said. You know, he told me when it warms up, I need to go out there and go swimming in his flying fishing boat. So I might have to figure that out.
We'll extend that same courtesy. Anytime we're out here, and you're welcome to come fly with us. And I
cool.
guarantee you, it's nothing like you've been even. You know, we've all flown a lot of airplanes, and there's nothing quite like it.
Yeah. Well, I told my wife about it, and she's all excited. So, which is kind of rare. She's had some fun experiences with warbirds, and not thrilled about riding in them. But she'll go for a flying boat ride. So.
Yeah, we get there, and it's kind of fun because we'll get out there to the lake, and we'll throw the anchor out, and next thing you know, we're surrounded by 20 or 30 boats.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like a party on wings,
yeah.
And people are really great, and they're all interested in the airplane and seeing something different.
Yeah. Does it take on water at all? Do you bilge pumps and all that necessity?
A little bit of water. I mean, you can't hit the water at, you know, 90 miles an hour and not, no matter how tight the airplane is. They've got drain plugs in them. And that's one of the things you got to make sure, one of the most important parts of pre-flight, and make sure all the drain plugs are in, because you'll turn into a static display on the bottom of the lake real quick if you don't put the drain plugs in.
Yeah.
So that's one of the most important things to do. But after every flight, we'll land the airplane, we'll pull the drain plugs, and there's water always coming out of it. There's no two ways around that.
Yeah.
And,
but it's very little. We've spent hours out there on the lake, and the most you ever get is a few gallons. So it's the aircraft is very tight, both of them, Zeus and Pegasus.
Yeah, not enough to affect your CG or anything then.
No. It's and bilge pumps are in the process of, you know, we're putting them in, and just as a convenience more than anything. But as far as taking on enough water to cause problems, it doesn't happen. It's a very forgiving airplane. It's you know, they call it the Grumman production facility, the Grumman Ironworks, and the thing is really literally a tank on wings.
Sure.
And it'll do things that most seaplanes won't do. It'll land in heavy seas. It'll land on the ocean, which you can't do with a lot of. There's very few airplanes, the Catalina being another one that you can do. And, of course, you know, there's not too many of those out there flying.
No, not at all, not at all. Well, your airplane, I was just looking on your everythingalbatross.com website there. It's got quite a history. It's been around the world. I mean, I see Iceland and Cuba and Japan and Vietnam and all over the world.
It did get around in the Navy. It was deployed very actively for its entire time in the Navy. Pegasus, on the other hand, was pretty much just at Pax River and Pensacola and had very few hours on it. And as a result, it's actually the lowest hour albatross in existence. JB gets the benefit of that now, owning that one.
Yeah, but it's an interesting thing about that airplane, too, is if you read the history of it, it saved a lot of aviators during both Korea and Vietnam. And when you're in country, you know, dropping bombs over the north or of either Korea or Vietnam, if you got shot up, the best thing to do is get out over water. And you didn't want to go down over Indian country, so you'd get to the water, and they would ditch or eject over water, and then an albatross would come in and pick you up and take you back home to fly again.
Yeah, well, I see it in the history. It was here, was in Vietnam in 66, so that's some action, and Okinawa in the 60s, I guess, do you ever have guys that come that know the airplane, veterans that show up that are familiar with your airplane specifically?
Well, we were at Sun and Fun, probably the time we were there with you, and this old gentleman rolled up in a little cart, a little motorized cart, and he had a cast on one leg, and he kind of got up there, and he was staring at the airplane, kind of looking at it, and I walked over to him and said, "This airplane got a special place in your heart?" And he goes, "Well, let me tell you," says, "back in 66, I was over North Vietnam in an F-105 and got shot up pretty bad. And I made it out over the Gulf and ejected and landed. And one of these airplanes came and picked me up and brought me back home safe." So that was kind of a special moment. We got pictures with him. He's a really, really nice guy. He kind of teared up during the whole thing. And seeing that and being able to bring back memories like that is really important to us.
It could very well have been the same aircraft, but we have no way of knowing. Unfortunately, the logbooks tell you where they were stationed, but there's no detail that we can find anywhere, giving sort of the day-to-day history and the kinds of things that specific aircraft was able to do.
Yeah, you'd probably have to find it. Well, from my knowledge, most of that comes around if you actually find the pilot that was flying them that might have his logbooks or something. You know, other than that, that kind of day-to-day, like you said, day-to-day history kind of gets lost sometimes. But
well, maybe he's listening in right now. He can get in touch with us.
Well, I hope so. Well, you guys are – the airplane's not painted, and I guess you guys are looking for sponsors, or what are you going to do about paint?
Well, that's the $75,000 or $80,000 question. It takes a pretty specific process. You've got to seam seal it first, seal all the seams to keep salt water out, especially if you're doing saltwater landings, and then you paint over that. So, you know, we're entertaining options, and we eventually do want to get it painted. That's kind of the last thing. We've been working the last couple of years on the mechanics of the airplane, making sure it's reliable mechanically. We replaced a lot of parts on all the fuel pumps. There's four fuel pumps, two electric and two motor driven. We've replaced generators, and there's a lot of things we want to get before you do the final cosmetic thing of the interior and the exterior. When you're pulling panels, you know, you don't want to be scratching up your nice new paint job. So we'd like to get that taken care of prior to painting it, but we're looking forward to that, and we're entertaining different ideas on how to paint it.
We've got some big ideas. got a lot of things in the works, and we'll see which ones come through. But we've talked to documentary producer types and movie producers and other folks who could be very interested in putting Zeus to work for events where we can get them out in front of a bigger audience and help keep this history alive, help get in front of more people who can get the joy of just touching this piece of history.
Well, cool. I wish you guys luck in the future with this, with your airplane, and hope it continues to fly well, and I hope to come down and see you sometime, and don't make it down to Houston area voluntarily very often, but I will certainly endeavor to do so sometime. I'd love to come see the airplane. And you guys are available for air shows. I know you do a few air shows here and there. So there's always that if people are looking for something different to be on the ramp. So
yeah. And we did a couple of interesting shows. We did one a couple of years ago. Randy Ball's got an air show that he does up at Cedar Creek Lake.
Yeah, the 4th of July deal.
Exactly. And the fun part about that was it's all over water. And so they have the air box is actually over water. We did a simulated rescue. We had a down flyer in the water. We picked them up and flew off of them. So that was kind of the people that really, really enjoyed that. They got to see how the airplane is actually employed. So we're we're always liking to take it out and show it to people. And it's fun meeting people that have been on the airplane. We did a recent show down in Mobile, Alabama, the 100th anniversary of the Coast Guard Aviation. And we flew down on Connie's airplane. His is painted in authentic Coast Guard colors.
Right.
The only one that's allowed to be done that way. And just meeting all the guys there that flew the airplane or were on the airplane, it was very interesting. It was quite a thrill to see those old some of those old guys listen to their stories about when they actually flew it operationally.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the Coast Guard was the mid-'80s or whenever they quit flying them, so that's relatively recent history.
They were the last ones to fly them. They stopped flying them over on saltwater, and they just used them basically as land base. Back when I was an instructor down in Corpus, they were still flying them back in the late 70s, and I used to see them all the time. And it's just an interesting airplane to watch fly, and it was something I always wanted to do. And I'm just very, very lucky to be a part of all this and to have the opportunity to fly this great airplane.
Living the dream. That's always good. That's always good. Well, guys, I appreciate you being on with us tonight. We're going to skip on to our next guest, but I really appreciate you being here and coming on with us, talking about the airplane, and I hope to meet you guys here soon.
Zane, I'm sure we'll find the opportunity. Great being on the call with you.
All right. Enjoy. I appreciate it. Check them out at Everything Albatross on Facebook and everythingalbatross.com. online. Thanks, guys, and we're going to take a quick break here and be back with our next guest.
Live from Washington, D.C., this is Warbird Radio.
Hey, y'all, Tuck Carlson here, introducing my new video series, Tuck Carlson's How to Be a Warbird Pilot. I don't care what you fly. Warbird pilots are the coolest, and I can teach you how to be one. Best part is, you don't even need a plane. Hell, you don't even need to know what a warbird is just by my video. Inside, you'll learn all the important stuff, like how to fit a flight suit around a beer belly, and why that beer belly is a safety feature, how to ignore small children at air shows. I ain't got time for that. How to grow your ego and sign unreadable autographs. Plus, you'll learn why freedom's the greatest answer to any question. Hey, Tuck, why do you fly these awesome airplanes? For freedom? Or when your wife finds out how much you've spent? Damn it, Tuck. Why'd you spend $6,000 on Avgas? For freedom. So for freedom's sake, buy my video. Before long, people will be thinking you're somebody. You'll be sitting around campfires with real women, signing autographs, and petting pretty little baby bald eagles that you grew in redwood trees that you planted beside your hangar. Be awesome. Love freedom. And get your copy of Tuck Carlson's How to Be a Warbird Pilot right now. Hey, y'all, hurry, and I'll toss in a special bonus pack. Tuck Carlson's How to Look Good in Short Shorts Late at Night and in the Pilot Briefing. Trust me, short shorts are the coolest things ever. Call now!
Supporting bees, the old-fashioned way. This is Warbird Radio. Tune in. Take off.
Welcome back to the Texas Warbird Report, where it was a pretty good visit there with Stuart and Mike with the Everything Albatross at their HU-16 Albatross out of Conroe, Texas. And we're right into our next guest here, Paul. Paul Freeman, are you there with us?
Yes, I am. Hi, Zane. How you doing?
Doing well. Paul's a... doesn't sound like a Texan, but he's migrated this way, lives in Fort Worth, so he is one of us now. He has written a book, The Legendary Hunters of Texas, true story of courage, or honor, courage, and commitment, story about VFA 201, local fighter squadron, Navy fighter squadron. And thanks for being on with us, Paul.
Well, thanks for having me, Zane. And for the record, yeah, I am from Chicago, the North Side. Go Cubbies.
Well, we won't hold that against you.
All right. I like the Rangers, too.
Well, there you go. Well, you've come to your senses, and you know where the good weather is anyway. You wouldn't have had this 78-degree January day in Chicago today like it was here. It's beautiful, so...
Yeah, incredible.
Well, I appreciate you being on. I know we met at the Alliance Air Show. You were in the in their Legends tent there, and you've got your book going, and tell us a little bit about yourself. I guess you were a squadron mate or squadron member mate in this squadron.
Yeah, I was the aircraft maintenance chief when we went over to do the shock and awe airstrikes in 2003. I was in the unit from 1997 to 2004. 2004, I retired. We were just doing sorties down in Key West, local sorties every couple weeks, and 9/11 hit. And when 9/11 hit, it changed everybody's lives, you know.
Sure.
And the way it impacted our unit was, I guess this is a good segue to go into the story.
Sure.
What happened was is we were building up to go do the Northern airstrikes in Iraq. And Carrier Group 8, which is an active-duty air wing, they needed an F-18 squadron to supplement to go on cruise because one of the F-18 squadrons couldn't make it. So the Hunters of Fort Worth, we got called up. We're a reserve squadron, and we got mobilized. We mobilized, 100% manpower. We mobilized 60% of them were reservists. So they all got mobilized for a year, and we started doing the workups. And we accepted 12 new jets that were had some upgrades in it to go into combat, and we transferred 12 jets in 1 week's time. And then we went on. Yeah, it was an endeavor. The folks worked really hard, and we challenged everybody during that time frame. And in fact, the whole year was challenging in many aspects. So we got on board the USS Theodore Roosevelt. And we steamed across the Atlantic, entered the Rock of Gibraltar, and went off the coast of Syria. And we sat there. It seemed like for months, Zane, but the time frame was relatively short. We were waiting on the go-ahead to go in there and do our airstrikes and,
right.
and hit the infrastructure in northern Iraq so the special forces can move up north. And keep in mind, now, we did this with a reserve squadron. We were the first Navy reserve squadron in the history of the Navy to ever go into actual combat and perform our missions. I think there were seven other squadrons. Yeah.
That's an interesting little piece of history there that, most of the, from what I understand, I mean, I'm not a Navy guy, but from what I understand that right. most of the reserve squadrons and the Navy reserve squadrons, they just, I guess, fill slots that the active squadrons have gone off. The active squadrons go with combat. You guys come in and fill up the slots that they've left behind stateside or mm-hmm. Other kinds of maybe touring the Pacific or something like that. But you guys actually got into the shooting.
Yeah, we actually we dropped over 220,000 pounds of ordnance in like 2 weeks when we did our strikes. And it was, like I said, we tried to minimize collateral damage with the, we have laser guided and GPS guided missiles. So target accuracy was pretty awesome. We took out, like I said, the infrastructure, we took out bridges, we took out comm centers, and the runways too. And, our pilots are top notch. All our pilots in our squadron are handpicked. They were Top Gun pilots at one time on active duty. So
yeah.
we went on board the Roosevelt, Zane, even though a lot of the reservists had been out to sea in a long time, they had a lot of experience from their active duty days. So we picked up pretty quick out there and had a lot of success. Our pilots won the top hook awards out there for landing accuracy and the flight deck crew with the reserves and the active duty guys, us, we all integrated together, and we were a fine running machine into it, pretty quick. Yeah.
Well, that's one of the advantages. That's one of the advantages, the experience that a reserve squadron normally has. I know even in the Air Guard, in the Air Force and the Air Force Reserve units and the Navy Reserve units, there's some pretty old hats in that group, and some guys with a lot of flight time, a lot of experience, and like you said, you have to work up to an operational pace from just being a weekend and 2 weeks a year guy. But the experience that a reserve squadron can bring can be overwhelming.
Yeah, like I said, our curve, you know, we started excelling relatively quick once we got the kinks worked out. I just want to say something about the book, though, if I could, Zane.
Yeah, sure.
You know, the book intention was not to bring attention to myself. That's not what the idea was. You know, obviously the book is something much greater than myself. There's two purposes for the book: to preserve our squadron's history, which, like I said, we were the first reserve squadron in Navy history to ever go into combat. And the other purpose was to create a cause. So what I did was I was doing the 22 kill push-up challenge at the time, and some of my old squadron mates on the Facebook page, I went out and I put a post. I said, "Hey, where's our history? It's gone. The squadron got decommissioned in 2007 due to people that were higher pay grade than me. They made that decision. They shut us down, and it was gone." So I said, well, I want to donate this money and the proceeds back to the 22 kill program to help our veterans that are suffering from PTSD. And I thought that's a twofold process there. One, I'm helping out our fellow brothers and sisters in need. And two, the hunters, the legendary hunters, we're still making a difference, even though we're not a unit no more due to, the closure and the decommissioning.
Right.
But so it was a little more deep than just writing a book, and you know. But,
oh, sure.
I had no idea the attention I was getting was going to be like this.
Well, you know, you combine the things. You combine a passion for the squadron, for the history there, which is what we're all about here at Warbird Radio, and you combine that with helping with the veterans, which is, you know, underneath everything, you know, that's what we're all here for. As far as Warbird, the Warbird community is, you know, it is all about the veterans. It is all about the history. So you combine the two, you know, good for you, Paul. That's
Zane, you know,
take the attaboys and run with it. But I appreciate it.
And I'm trying not to make it about me.
I understand.
But at the same time, if I'm going to get out there and try and make a difference, the book is the catalyst in which I can go and help others. So I have to promote the book. Therefore, attention is brought upon myself, and that's fine. If that's, you know, I'm humbled by it. But, you know, the human interaction during this journey I'm on with this book, is not a big book. I'm not Ernest Hemingway by no means, but it's not a big book. But what the book has done is I've made some connections with complete strangers at these book signings, like where you saw me at the air show.
Sure.
What I've noticed with people, and I knew this before, but I've got a greater appreciation for the generosity of people. People would literally come by my booth and just drop money off and just keep walking because they wanted me to donate it to the cause.
Yeah.
But then there's some emotional times too, because of the, where I'm donating the money to the 22 kill, you know, for PTSD. I've had moments where I've had widows come up to me, stand in front of my booth and cry, and I didn't know why they were crying. So
yeah.
I don't know if you noticed, but I always had sunglasses around my neck when I'm out at these book signings. So I take them sunglasses. And yes, of course. I take them sunglasses, I pop them up on my eyeballs, and I get up and I go hug the individual. And they thanking me for donating money back to the cause. And one moment, I asked a young lady, I go, "Well, what's wrong?" And she said, "Well, I had a relative that just committed suicide from PTSD that was suffering from it 2 days ago." So when you have a moment like that, that instills drive and initiative for me to continue doing what I'm doing, because
sure,
it's just that is, it's just overwhelming, you know, and to see the generosity, and at the same time, see the other end of the spectrum, you know, people that actually have family members or friends that, you know, committed suicide because they couldn't deal with the, you know, PTSD, symptoms, you know, so
right.
It's,
sure.
That's my drive, Zane, yeah. You know?
Well, it's a good drive to have, and it's a worthwhile program for sure. It's important that we take care of these guys. It is,
yes.
You know, the business of war is a stressful thing for sure. And these guys need to be taken care of. And, you know, there's all kinds of organizations out there to do this. And every little bit from you and from everybody else out there really helps. You know, don't think that it doesn't help. It does help. You have to raise awareness of this stuff as well. And that's what 22 Kill does.
Yes.
And that's what you're doing as well. You know, there's a lot of people don't have any, have no clue that this is, that it's such a problem, and it is a problem.
The
veterans need our help. So, you know, it's a worthwhile cause.
Yes. I have a simple model, you know, it's one way, it's a small way. It's better than no way to do something positive to help others in need. You know, it's, I'm just trying to do what I can to help others. And, and that's really it, you know, and, you know, I'm also partnering with, Pause for Cause. I don't know if I told you that or not.
Oh, okay.
Pause for Cause is going to be at my book signing events. And what that program's about is they train the service dogs that they eventually will give to veterans who are suffering from PTSD to help them with well-being, you know, give them a companion. And, sure. So that's a good program as well. So I just wanted to put that out there, that the book signings I'll be at, Pause for Cause will be there as well in the future.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. It's great. Well, yeah, you know, it's, like you said, it's important that we take care of these people, and, you're doing it. As far as the book goes, what has the response been from squadron members, over the years?
Well, when I wrote the book, keep in mind, I'm covering 37 years. So
sure.
You got the old timers, you got the, you know, and then you got the, you know, the newer generation, and we all served in the unit. And my goal was to try and show respect to the squadron members that were back in the 70s that were, you know, they cut the teeth for the unit, the hunters of Texas.
Yeah.
And I wanted to recognize them and not diminish anything they did. Everything they did created the foundation for our squadron to have the success that we did when we actually got called up into real combat.
Yeah. So, and this squadron based at Dallas Navy originally, and their first airplane they stood up with the F-8 Crusaders.
Yes, they did.
Originally,
yep. So, F-8 Crusaders. Then they went on to the F-4s, and then they had the F-14, and then they Dallas shut down and moved over to Fort Worth and Naval Air Station Joint Reserve Base Fort Worth.
Right.
And that's when I joined the unit, when it had F-14s. And then we transitioned to F-18s later on.
Well, I had a cousin that was a 201 member, retired out of the 201. Yeah. Flew F-14s, a little fella, Larry Musinski. He was, he's a cousin, and he was one of the, he went up against the Libyans one day over the Mediterranean in the Gulf of Sidrus. So there's my name drop and claim to fame there. But we were out there on the ramp when his retirement flight. Cousins invited us out. We were out there when he came screaming across in the F-14. So that was fun.
Well, and those are the folks in the earlier days that I want to show proper respect. You know, I mean, like I said, you know, before us, it was them, and they laid the foundation for this great squadron. And, you know, the book has got recognized by Kay Granger, Congresswoman in Fort Worth here as well. She was pivotal in trying to keep the unit open in 2007.
Wow.
And she couldn't do it. She couldn't fight the Department of Defense. And, So she sent me a nice letter, and, you know, everything I get from this book is not just for me. It's for all the men and women who served in the unit. I mean, sure, my name's on it, but it's, you know, I'm just a catalyst here to keep things going. That's all.
Yeah. Did you have any trouble finding history and things? Some veteran interviews and some book history and this kind of thing all together?
Well, with social media, it's easy to reach out to folks. And, you know, I had so much input at the beginning of the book when I was sitting there writing the manuscript, my little kitchen table here, that, you know, I had to come up with a vision. So my vision was is to lay the book out in this way. I wanted the F8 era. I wanted the F4 era, F14. And then I segued into 9/11 attacks. And then what happened for our unit after 9/11, we got called up and we went over and did the shock and awe airstrikes over there. And then we came back and I end the book with the decommissioning. You know, that's kind of what I was trying to do there. I could have wrote 400, 500 pages of, for this unit. There's so much rich history. There's so many great characters, leaders, and stories. But I was just trying to do something simple to get it out there. I'm not bashful about writing another one, maybe a bigger book and cover more more intimate details about, you know, the people in the unit. But for initially, my objective was to capture the history, talk about what we did, the 1st Reserve Squadron, Navy history to go to combat, and preserve that. So that was my initial intent with this book as far as, you know, setting it up. But I had plenty of input.
Okay. And, done on it. It's a heck of an endeavor to do so. And the book is available on Amazon. Legendary Hunters of Texas. So look it up there. And we're going to have to run a little short on time here, Paul, but I really appreciate you coming on. And I want to just...
Well, thank you, Zane.
Well, thank you for doing this for 22 Kill and Pause for Cause and helping to take care of our veterans, Paul. Nothing more better can be done than to do that. And I sure miss seeing the hunters fly around Fort Worth. I got to see them all the time. And that red stripe flying out there, it's surely missing. But thank you for coming on, Paul. Yeah. We appreciate it. And go out and buy his book,
you,
everybody.
Zane.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Well, that was Paul Freeman from Fort Worth, Texas. And go check out his book on Amazon. It's out there ready to go. And it's not expensive, and it sure helps. Can help the veterans, so... it's great to be back on the air here at Warbird Radio, Texas Warbird Reports coming to you. I need to send a little plug out. I promised I would to our friend Frank Kimmel of Kimmel Aviation Insurance. He sent me a calendar with a picture of me and Mark Todd and Chuck Gardner. I'm sitting in the back of the Kate there. So if you have that insurance calendar from Kimmel, it's there in April. There's my claim to fame as well. So I'm immortalized in the back seat. You can't see me, but it was good fun. Greg Moorhead did a great job on that, flying along with Trey Carroll and the rest of us out of Dallas there and back in November. So need to give Frank Kimmel a plug since he sent me a free calendar. So I appreciate it. Well, that's all the time we have for tonight for the Texas Warbird Report. We will see you next month. Here on WarbirdRadio.com. Thank you, everybody.